Our next presentation is Francesco Marincola from the National Institute of Health, who will be discussing understanding rejection, how and why through the melanoma model.
That's great. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thanks, Ida. She asked me to make some comments about the importance of industry academia partnership, but really I don't have much to say because it's a learning experience here for me. I've always been a proponent of this, but I think it's, you are doing the best in the world in this, so I would be preaching and telling nothing new. I do believe that this is the only viable solution for the future, and although I agree with Dr. Weissman that maybe we have different goals in academia, government, and industry, they are not mutually exclusive. And in fact, we can help each other quite a lot by respecting and understanding the difference. And in some ways, it's almost paradoxical the last few years where we had these problems, financial problems in all areas, I think, have been the most productive in my lab. And I don't think it's just a coincidence. I think where a lot of silos are breaking and a lot of people are realizing that maybe it's better to work together. And in fact, by starting to share resources, we're all starting to share also what is the cheapest, the most important thing we can do, which is knowledge. And so I think actually this meeting is really amazing. It's really beautiful. And when I go around and people ask me about good examples of translational research, I always say the Moores Cancer Center. The only problem is, and it's a good example because there is not translational in the Moores Cancer Center world, so I guess facts are more important than words. But maybe we should change it. So it's going to be easier for me to make my point in the future, but it's really a wonderful thing that I'm looking at today. I'm learning a lot. So today, how do you go forward? What is this? I would like to discuss what we have learned by studying the mechanism of rejection following different models, but in particular the melanoma model. And I would start with this slide, which summarizes a lot of work from my lab and as well many other groups in during the late 90s and early part of this millennium, where we looked at the effect of immunization against cancer. It was just after this discovery of the genes, the antigens that are recognized by the T cells. And so, for example, this is a vaccine, GP100, that is expressed by melanoma. And when it's given in a different with different immunization, you develop T cells that recognize the vaccine, and they increase in number very consistently to the point that we had patients that 50% of their circulating CD8 cells recognizing the antigen as well as tumor cells. But the most important thing is that there was absolutely no relationship with response. So you have all these T cells, and paradoxically, nothing happens. And that actually makes perfect sense if you really look at the fact that it's not such a linear, simple relationship between developing a reagent and having an effect. Because when you look in the peripheral circulation for T cells to recognize the antigen, you're really looking at a very first dimension of what you're expected to see to cause tumor rejection. You really know whether, first of all, if they go to the tumor site, if they're activated there, just having T cells per se. Every immunologist knows that T cells alone don't do anything. You have to activate them. And so do they get an environment there that causes their activation? But most importantly, what we realize and more is that we really had to learn more about what happens within the tumor, because tumors as well as the immune response can change dynamically very quickly, and also tumors are quite different. You saw beautiful examples of that today, even among different patients or within the same patient. And so we became interested in studying the mechanism of rejection and what happens, trying to understand what happens when tumors reject or not by studying directly the tumor, which has been kind of a real struggle to do in humans because it's very difficult to convince clinicians to look at that. So I will discuss two things. How does tumor rejection occur? And most recently, what I've been trying to work on in our lab is why does it occur in some people and not other ones. So how does tumor rejection occurs is something that brought to the what we call the identification of the immunological constant of rejection. And most important part of my talk there, really by interacting with people and different groups and comparing experiences with people studying other phenomena, it's amazing how quickly you can learn things that otherwise you'll have to go discover by yourself in a much less efficient way. So this is an example of serial biopsy ways in which we studied the mechanism of rejection of cancer. We did fine needle aspirate of lesions before and after treatment, and this was done by using fine needle aspirate so we could follow specifically individual lesions. And when we looked at the post-treatment biopsies, we could tell directly whether the lesions went away or they continued to grow. And if you compare lesions that didn't change, they continued to grow, in fact, there were no significant difference whatsoever between before treatment and after treatment, showing that when there is no rejection, it's simply because nothing happens. The treatment doesn't get there. This is that we're all complete responders. These are all lesions that eventually all of them, from being at least 2 to 3 centimeters in diameter, disappear completely. And these are the impaired analysis before and after treatment. And, of course, this was the biopsy were done early on in the treatment so that we didn't have a chance to go away completely. And at that point came that the gene that was by far the most significantly upregulated in responding lesions was interferon regulatory factor 1. Even at that time, it was known that this gene, it was important for other types of rejection, like a response of genital warts to a toll receptor stimulating agent, and also the response of carcinoids and leukemias to interferon alpha. But it was not as recognized as later on that to be the major modulation of the switch from chronic to acute inflammation. Everybody now that's studying that, you will know the RF1 is the major key gene that switches this phenomenon. We did many of these studies, and for example, another study we did, which is a good example of federal partnership with the industry, there was a study that was designed with 3M, was to try to understand the mechanism of action of rejection of tumors. And obviously, when you do this in immunotherapy, when the most tumors are now rejected, it's very difficult and very expensive and time-consuming effort. But here there was a beautiful model. It's basal cell carcinoma. And in this case, the basal cell carcinoma was treated with imiquimod, with a toll receptor 7 agonist. And this treatment, when given intensely, causes almost 100% disappearance of the tumors locally, through an immune-mediated mechanism, because obviously the toll receptor agonist alone doesn't do anything to the cancer cells. So it was a good model to try to understand what happens when you reject the tumors. And so that's what we found. If you looked at pre-treatment versus post-treatment lesions, we identified a set of genes that are very specific for rejection. These are all the pre-treatment lesions. The biopsy done on the same lesion in the placebo group. This was a placebo randomized study. And then a very important point I want to show is the time when you look at the phenomena to find that. You have to really be very careful in your study design. These are 4 days and these are 8 days. And as you can notice, at 4 days, almost nothing was happening. And only after 8 days that the switch of inflammation occurred. And that was kind of a learning experience because based on mouse model, we would have predicted the day 4. But the only reason why we did the day 8 time point was because Bert Slade, which was the VP at 3M then, being much more experienced than we were in clinical trials, say, well, maybe we should add a day 8 because human skin is thicker than mouse skin. And so it turned out, I don't know if that was the reason, but really it was a good learning experience. But what this study allowed us to do was to define what we call the immunologic constant rejection by 500 genes that are very important for rejection to occur. And these are only a selection of them. To give an example, the major classes. And so one of the classes was the STAT1, RF1, RF5, class, which is downstream of it, stimulates all these genes associated with HLA class 1, IL-15 regulation, as well as all these receptor IL-15 and allograft inflammatory factor. There is another group of genes that are associated with immune effector functions, and then there is a group of chemokines, which are the CXCR3 and the CCR5 ligands, which we have found over and over in many other studies we did later on to be always expressed every time you have we have rejection, or what we call immune mediated tissue-specific destruction. And if we summarize this recently, you know, in a brief meta-analysis where we compare the tumor type rejection with graft rejection. And if you compare all the studies done where people have looked at this mechanism of rejection in different ways, you will find everything goes back to RF1 and STAT1 and then these four categories of genes. These are not exclusive of other genes, but these are the most consistently seen no matter what model system you look at and what species and what other things you're looking. And in fact, we can even, for the skeptics, we were able to prove that this happens in mice too, and so I were much more happy that we could prove that. And so a meta-analysis of three studies done where microarrays were applied to kidney, acute kidney allograft rejection, and they came up exactly with the same, if you want, STAR1, RF1 pathway in the genes that here, you have believed me because there was some kind of different nomenclature, but basically are all the same genes that are belong to the four groups we described. And we put together a book with Anna Wang, which was one of the most of the work I'll present today, asking people, groups from all over the world that had studied mechanism of this immune-mediated tissue destruction by using different technology, but studying the tissues. And more or less, no matter where you look at cancer prognosis, all the famous work of Jerome Galland, which is classifying tumors according to their immune phenotype, mechanism of tumor rejection, both mice and human models, allograft rejection, graft versus host disease, clearance of pathogen, acute infection. All of this seems to have this theme where we ask the authors to look at, in particular, at the presence of this group of genes. You see that most of the times you will find consistently this group of genes. And so we come up with a conclusion that the mechanism of rejection is unique, is common in many, many forms of immune pathologies. And it's kind of a concentric circle where you go from a chronic inflammatory situation where really you have some kind of tissue destruction but it's not complete and effective, to an inflammatory switch, probably mediated for unknown reason by interferon gamma and IL-12, which brings the production of CXCR3 and CCR5 ligands, which like CXCL9 and CCL5. And this, in turn, brings activated T and NK cells, which have a receptor, which bring eventually the full activation or even an explosion there over a rejection that causes a rejection. And in the case of allograft rejection or immunity, you start from here and with immune suppression try to go outward. In case of clearance of pathogen and tumor rejection, you start from a situation that's lingering, and with immune stimulation we try to go in that. So while the mechanism is pretty much appreciated now, and most people would agree that works on this, that this is the very common and conserved mechanism of rejection, the mechanism why you get there, however, very, very different. So why eventually it happens. And so we have been very interested in looking at that. But before this, we did this in many, many, many models, but I want just to briefly show two more examples that we did recently, which are kind of interesting because this was finally being able to prospectively reproduce the original data I showed before of the RF1 situation. So a study we did in collaboration with UVA where people were given interleukin-2, people with melanoma, and these are the pre-treatment biopsies, the post-treatment. I'm showing just the post-treatment results here to show the mechanism. So we're doing the mechanistic part, not the predictive part at the moment I'm showing you. And so if you look at lesions that responded versus non-responded and compare in the post-treatment the difference between responding and non-respond, once again being followed directly because we did find needle, so we knew exactly where lesions went away. And you look what pathway are stimulated in the responding, you find that all of these pathways, there are among 400 potential pathways which are ranked according to significance, The first one is antigen presentation, which is an RF1-mediated mechanism. And so forth. All of them are immunologic-related pathways, dendritic cell maturation, autoimmune thyroiditis, primary immune deficiency, allograft rejection, lupus erythematosus, type 1 diabetes, graft versus host disease. So all the canonical pathway that you see when a melanoma is rejected reflect what you see in many other pathways associated with any form of rejection. This is a very, very common thing. We have done many studies, and that's what you find. And this is not random. There are 400 pathways here. All in this, the congregation of them at the top shows that really you have an acute inflammatory process. And I want to show another anecdotal study, which again shows how much you can learn from few very well-defined phenotypes. In this case, we were able to study two patients with a mixed response. I'm showing one of it. It was a collaboration with Granada, University of Granada in Spain. This patient in particular had metastatic melanoma, had six lesions. At that time, was treated with GM-CSF and a vaccine. And three of the lesions were shrinking and three were growing. And at that time, Federico Garrido removed them from the patient. And we did a lot of studies, including microarrays. And we did it on two patients. So we have several lesions. And it took us 10 years to find these two patients, the rare mixed responders. But that's an important point because then you kind of eliminate the genetics of the patient or the environmental factor differences in treatment because all happens at the same time in the same patient. And when you looked again, and you look at what pathways are the more important, first one antigen presentation and so forth, always the same, diabetes, autoimmune disease, allograft rejection, graft versus host disease, and so forth. So it is pretty much sure that when you have a rejection, you have a very common phenomenon that is very highly reproducible. So why does it? And I want to just spend the last few minutes to try to explain what we're doing now to deconvolute from knowing what you are expecting to happen for something to a rejection to occur to how you get from to why is it happening. And that's obviously much more complicated story, and probably each patient is a different story. And if you really look at simple categories, you can imagine it's the genetics or epigenetics or whatever, the phenotype of the tumor could be a factor, the host genetic, and of course environmental factors or external factors, for example, the effectiveness of treatment. And so I'll give you two opposite point of view. One would say that tumor genetic is the major modulating factor because, as I showed before, the L2 model I just showed before, some tumors respond or not, and particularly the mixed response model supports that. So, for example, the same patients we showed before, this is a cohort of the original few patients, two of them had underwent a complete response to a stable disease. These are biopsies performed before treatment. And even before treatment, supposed to have a circle here, the responding lesions were different. We published this, I'm not going to go through all the details, but the interesting thing is they had similar signatures to the ones that were seen afterwards, though enhanced during the response. So they were already inflamed, that activated. So in that the tumors themselves are different, they respond from the ones that don't respond. But again, going just reminding you about the mixed responder experience, you can tell that pretty much, you know, with the same genetic background, the same treatment, tumors can be different, suggesting that tumors are maybe the major a major component of the decision-making whether a response occurs or not. But then again, I'll give you the opposite view, and these are three studies. Obviously, I'm not going to show the study, but I'm going to show only one example. But there are three major studies that we have been doing in which we have been observing that, in fact, there is a major component that is genetic of the person. One is the study of adoptive TIL therapy, where we have been analyzing what happens when you give tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes to patients. I'll show an example later. And we analyzed those. And we found that in a 200-case cohort, that there is a big variation between the ones that respond, eventually will lead to response, the ones that don't. And what turns out to find, we found was that there is a signature of cells cells there, they're of genes that are associated with an immature phenotype of T cells, which is the opposite of what we would have expected, which eventually brought to the identification with Luca Gattinoni and Nick Restivo of these stem cell-like T cell effector T cells. We have been published in a few manuscripts, that one actually coming out in Nature in the next pretty soon, where we looked, in fact, at immunological phenotype, metabolic phenotype of these stem cells. And another one that we learned something about, but the important thing is there were no predictors in the tumor that would tell us whether the T cells would be different in people that responded or not. We're really genetically determined, and we're trying to figure out what is the mechanism that causes some people to have this stem cell-like population and others don't have. We also looked at the CXCR3 and CCR5 expression, these receptors in T cells, because we know that they are important for localization. And we learned something really important, because this also shows a mixture of importance of the genotype of the person, the individual, versus the importance of the tumor phenotype. Because when we looked individually at different receptor expression in these T cells, we found that each one alone was barely significant. There was a trend to predict response. What really made a difference was the combination of both, because they have these two receptors are redundant functions, and so if one was there or the other was there, it would negate each other. But when they're either both present or both absent, we're very strongly predictors. But interesting enough, when you added to that the DNA analysis, looking at the genetics of the patient, and the CCR5, for example, genes is very interesting, because many of us have what is called the Delta 32 mutation, which basically produces a protein that doesn't function. If you add that to the permutation, we call it protein prediction model, we found that you become even more predictive. And then when we looked at the tumor phenotype, the production of chemokines by the tumor, that would improve even more the prediction model. So it is a combination of studying tumors, RNA, protein, and DNA, that really made a very, very, very strong predictor, making the point that really just simple class comparison using one platform just doesn't help trying to understand this phenomenon. We have to improve the way we do our studies by being a little bit more hypothesis driven. So I'm going to go very briefly to finish with the RF5 stories, which is making the last point I want to make today. So this is the TIL study that we was telling you about. The tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes are removed from tumors by a donor lesion and are grown in IL-2 and TILs. Many times we develop cell lines if we can. Then the T cells are given back to the patients. And what you see is dramatic. You see major responder peoples that come with huge cancers that are gone completely. Even these were patients being already almost 7 years away off after having this major cancer that went away completely. So it's a real phenomenon. It happens relatively frequently with this very strong therapy, but it's still fascinating why some people respond and some don't. And so we focused in many issues, but one I want to finish with is the RF5 story, the RF1, RF1 story. Again, try to deconvolute from the immunologic constant rejection. We looked at, I told you, at the CXCR3, CCR5 ligands, but I want to show the why we started looking at things like RF5 gene. And the reason is because if it's true that tumor rejection is the same thing that autoimmunity is, basically is a tumor-specific autoimmune phenomenon, then things that matter for autoimmunity should matter for tumor rejection. And in fact, we believe that autoimmunity is important for tumor rejection, because there are plenty of examples of studies that have shown that when you develop autoimmunity during treatment of melanoma in particular here, you're going to be more likely to have a response, a rejection. So we thought, well, what about studying RF5? Is it an important transcription factor in our immunologic constant rejection interferon-related pathways, regulates expression of interferon genes and also of apoptosis, but most importantly, it's very strongly associated with the development of lupus and many, many other autoimmune diseases shown by many groups. So we decide, well, maybe we should study and see what happens. And I'm going to make it very short. We studied many polymorphisms, but one in particular here, it turned out to be highly predictive or response. If you look at the TILs, this in tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes we talked about, there was a preference, a difference in presence of one genotype versus the other in responding versus non-responding. And so eventually what we did, we compare, we started considering patients, we gave the patients the genotype of, that we consider, and because the allele has a dominant function, I don't have the time to show all the data, but it's a dominant function, we congregated the A and the AA and GA phenotype on one side and the GG on the other one. It turns out that if you then take the genomic data and you compare, you classify patients according to their genotype and look at their genes that are different between them and then look at the prediction, they have a highly predictive or response because here the yellow is the orange are the non-responding people and the CRs are the blue one, the PRs are the ones in the partial responder in the middle. Suggesting really that just one little snip, one little polymorphism could be highly predictive sometime, although it's not 100% predictive, because if you can see here, it's something that we see over and over, is that while there is a genotype, and a phenotype, sorry, that can predict a lack of response, there is another group of people that don't respond, it seems to me, seems more behaving like the ones that should respond. And that's respond, and it's something we've seen over and over. It's much easier to predict non-response than response. And the reason is pretty obvious if you think about it, because there takes much more to for something to happen than not happening. An example classic, if you're going duck hunting, you need to have a gun, because with a gun you're never going to shoot a duck, but then you need to have ducks, you need to have know how to shoot, and all the other things. So it's much, much easier to predict non-responsiveness. And then to finish, we had cell lines. We analyzed the cell lines, and we looked at differences between them because we want to see, well, maybe it's the microenvironment that causes the variation or it's really intrinsic in the tumor phenotype. Cell lines, each cell line matched each other no matter what kind of treatment received, in this case interferon alpha. So, in fact, interferon alpha or not, they stayed together, but they're clustered together independent of whether they were treated or not with interferon. The GG phenotype were different from the GA or AA phenotypes. And we did many other cell lines as just an example. So we analyzed what are these genes that are different, independent of treatment, that make the two different cell lines different. And then we took those genes and we applied to the tumors again. And once again, we found that these genes selected from the cell line predicted response versus non-response. So in conclusion, we changed somewhat the model in which we're working, and we don't have much time, so I can give you this kind of general studies. But what we're thinking about is that really, it's not really a host genetic and tumor genetics, but a combination of both, keeping in mind that all tumors bring the genetics of the host. So if a bunch of polymorphisms are going to be exactly the same in the tumors, and this is underappreciated many times. People will show the tumor different people clustered separately, of course, because they are different. They have a huge genotype difference between them. It's not just simply the clonal derivation. And of course, all the environmental factors are that. And therefore, we have now a model where we try to combine, is that the tumor or the host? And probably what really happened is there are some people that are less likely, they have in their own genetics, are less likely to respond to treatment or to develop autoimmunity or whatever it is. These people most likely will not respond. But then if you do have a genotype that is favorable to response, then it's the genetic of the cancer that comes. It's the other factor. If you have the cancer, some misses target molecules or produces thing that blocks the effect of treatment, also this is going to block your response. So it's a cofactorial. So it's not the host, it's not the cancer, but the combination of things that eventually can explain all the paradoxes we're seeing. And then after that, if still all of this seems to work, you have the gun, you have, you know how to shoot, at one point, even if the duck is here, you have to have something that is going to be effective. So some treatment are going to be more likely to be effective than other ones, or other environmental factors that we're seeing over and over in Center of Human Immunology. Even our own immune system keeps changing completely, whether we eat or not, whether it's the evening or whether you have a flu or a vaccine. So many other cofactors that we call hidden factors that affect the final result. So these are algorithms now that we're trying to study to identify what happens with cancer rejection when it happens, and also we try to apply working with other groups to chronic infection as well as autoimmune diseases. So to finish, I want to make a little recommendation here. I really hope you like my talk, but I want to remind you, before criticizing somebody, you should walk at least 1 mile in that person's shoes. Because, therefore, if the person does not take the criticism well, you are at least a mile away and the guy has no shoes. So based on that, I'm ready for questions.